So this morning, we're going to talk about God's eternal nature, all right? We're following through on a sermon series that Carlton's preaching on the attributes of God, and as Carlton and I were talking about which one I would get to speak on, he read a list of about 30 attributes, and when he got to God's eternal nature, I said, that's it. I love that concept. It made me stay up at night when I was a kid. It made me think about what is eternity, what does forever mean? I want to preach on that. And then he said, cool, you get to. And I went away and I thought about it and went, what did I get myself into? Like, how do you explain God's eternal nature? So when God steps in and says that he is eternal, it's a huge statement. So if you would, open your Bibles. And the Pew Bibles is going to be on page 40. It's Exodus 3. Verse 14. I'm going to put it on the screen for you as well. It's a short verse, but it's a powerful verse. It says this, God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. Okay, so what's needed here is a little bit of context, right? So in Exodus 2, just one chapter before, we see the entire lifespan of Moses up till now. Moses was born to a Jewish woman in a time where Pharaoh, the Jews were under captivity to the Egyptians, and the Pharaoh had decided to kill all the male boys born to Jews. When Moses' mother had him, she thought, well, I'm not going to kill my son, and I'm not going to let them kill my son, so I'm going to put him in a basket, float him down the river. He's got a better chance that way than me actually killing him, right? So what happened? Moses was picked up by Pharaoh's daughter. She was allowed to keep him. She raised him as her own son. So all of a sudden, this little Jewish boy becomes an Egyptian prince. He grows up, and at the end of chapter 2, you see that he actually grows up and gets in a little scuffle. He sees an Egyptian mistreating a Jew, and he kills him in cold blood. So now he's a Jewish boy who grew up as an Egyptian prince who murdered an Egyptian for no reason, justifiably. So he's like, uh-oh, right? And he skedaddles. And he ends up meeting some friendly Jewish family and marrying into their family and just becoming a shepherd. Kind of hiding out. And this is where we find him, where God finds him tending sheep as a shepherd, and God appears to Moses in a burning bush. And he says, I'm going to use you to set my people free. And Moses says, They're never going to believe me. Right? This context matters because why would they believe him? He's an expatriate, twice removed, and a murderer on the run, living out, just trying to hide. And God says, no, I'm going to use you, and you're going to help set my people free. And he argues with them, and the first thing God says is, I will be with you, right? And he says, it's still not good enough. I don't talk good. And God's final answer to Moses for why Moses is going to be used by God is this right here, 3:14. I am who I am. This is what you're to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. Because Moses just said, God, when I go to them and I say the things you're going to tell me to say, they're going to say, well, who really told you to say these things? Right? And some scholars have gone back and forth on this text saying, well, does this mean that the Israelites didn't have a name for God? Is this like the first time that God's name appears? And the answer comes up, no, they knew how to refer to God before, but God uses grammar in this sentence to simply say that he is eternal, that God's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And it's a huge claim, and it's actually the claim that pushes Moses over the brink and helps him realize, I need to do what God says, because God is. And with that eternal nature comes a weight of power that should not and cannot be argued with. And this is the same God we serve. To help us out a little bit, there's a definition of God's eternal nature written by a theologian named Wayne Grudem that I'd like to share with you. He says, God has no beginning, end, or succession of moments in his own being, and he sees all time equally vividly, yet God sees events in time and acts in time. It's a pretty complicated description. I'm going to try to explain it with a drawing. Here's a line that represents all of time, okay? Pretty straightforward. Then when we enter into how God sees all of time, he can see the beginning, he can see the end, and he can see the middle. And he can interact with any of those that he chooses to. He has complete power over his situation with regard to time. And none of it is a secret from him, and none of it dictates what God does. Another way to think of this is a parade. If you think about us as members of the parade, we're just walking in our spot. I was actually in marching band for quite a few years and played trombone, so I got to be in front of my band because you hit people if you're behind them. But so as you're marching, you only know your spot and you only know the people in front of you. You don't even get to see behind you very well. But God's in the hot air balloon looking at the whole thing. He can tell what's happening at the beginning, the middle, and the end. And we'll take it a step up. God's the director of the parade. He gets to tell you when to start, when to stop. But the problem is we don't always treat him quite like he is. So I'd like to go to how we respond to God's eternal nature. And if you would, turn to Psalm 90. It's on page 413 if you're in a pew Bible. Psalm 90 is a psalm that was actually written by Moses later on in life. And this is Moses describing God. He says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn men back to dust, saying, return to dust, O sons of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. You sweep men away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. Though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it's dry and withered. This is Moses just recognizing later on in life. We see him younger when God's saying, do what I say, and he says, why? And in Exodus 3, God says, because I am. And then later on in life, we see Moses saying, yeah, Lord, you are in charge. You are the God in charge of how time works and how time affects things and how time runs. And we need to listen. So I'd like to submit to you a few things that we can learn from the idea that God is eternal. The first one is humble yourself. You're not in control of time. I've said this a few times. I don't think we can emphasize this enough as we talk about God's eternal nature. We all think we're in charge, right? We all think we know what we can and cannot do. James in chapter 4 addresses this. And again, this is on page 849 in your pew Bibles. In James 4:13, he says, now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go do this or do that. Oh, sorry. Go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. I mean, this hits me hard. This is one of those verses, and this is one of those situations where I constantly make plans arrogantly. I constantly think I'm in charge of my calendar and of my time. I'm overbooking myself left and right. And here James is clearly saying, because God's in charge of time and because my time, the more I understand God's role in the universe and God's role in my life, isn't my time at all. It's his time. Who am I to say, I'm going to go do this and I'm going to go do that? I love how James even throws in there, we're going to go this place or that place and make money. It's what we do. I'm going to go to work tomorrow and make money, right? But we should humble ourselves and realize that it is up to God's will what's going to happen in our lives and submit to us. Submit to that. That's the first step. Second thing I'd like to offer you is that we trust God because he's already been there. When God says to Moses, I am sent you, he's not saying the guy who thinks he knows what's going to come. But he's saying the God who's been there already is sending you. I'd like to illustrate this with a story from my own life. I really like being outdoors. As often as I can, I go camping. I like backpacking. There's one place, typically I don't like desert too much, but there's one place that's the exception for me. It's Joshua Tree National Park. And I go out there as often as I can. The problem is I'm not very good at climbing, and so I always have to go out with people that are. So most recently, the college group went to Joshua Tree, and I used that as a... that was really embarrassing, guys. The college group went to Joshua Tree, and I tagged along. And this is kind of the scene that you can see. Piles of rocks like this, and you climb up on them, and you get ropes, and you kind of do it safely. And then every once in a while, they come up with a new idea. Well, I hadn't been in a few years, and the guys had started climbing through caves. And I say it with air quotes because I don't think these are caves. They're piles of rocks that you crawl down into, and you may or may not get lost, and you may or not ever come out again. And it's not like a real, like, I think of a cave like, you know, Yogi Bear is going to come out of, but this is like, you go into that pile of rocks. So I go in there, and this is my trusty guide. His name is Judd, and the college kids aren't there yet. And Judd says, come on, man, we got to go, like, get these glow sticks in the right spot and get all the stuff lined up so the college kids don't die. And I was like, okay. So we start going down there, and I don't call myself, like, claustrophobic. I don't typically think of myself that way. But once we get into spots like this, I start thinking, like, yeah, this rock's been here for a while, but it might move, you know? And, like, I'm a little bit thinner than I used to be, but, I mean, I still don't want to try to fit through that, you know? And so we get to places like this, and I asked Chip Fisher's permission to show this picture of him. So you're actually coming through a bigger area into this smaller area, and you're, like, squeezing through that thing, right? And there's a mountain on top of you, and there's a pile of rocks. And at this point, I said, no. Right? That's it. No. I'm turning around. I'm going back. We're not taking college kids through this. This is stupid. And Judd, we'll go back to this guy so you can really see what he looks like. Judd looks at me and he says, I've done this 1,000 times. You're going to get through. You're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to whine a lot. And you're going to get through this. And you know what? It was that part. Sorry, I'm trying to find a black screen so you guys don't have to look at that. It was that part that urged me through. That Judd had been there before. That he knew where he was going. That he knew the path. That this rock wasn't going to squish me. That I was going to be able to breathe. And I was going to make it to the other side. Helped me realize, all right, I've got a guide who knows what's going on. And so we trust because he's already been there. It's a deep truth in life. Again, I told you when I started thinking about this, speaking on God's eternal nature, when I was a kid and I started really starting to trust God and starting to pour through the Bible, this theme of God being forever was one of the first things that grabbed me. And actually working with youth for so long as a middle schooler, that's a typical question that I would ask a middle schooler at camp or something is, do you understand what it means that God is forever? It's a hard concept. And your brain kind of starts exploding. You can see like smoke coming out of like seventh graders' ears as they start like trying to figure out God was never had a beginning, never had an end. And it's scary to think about. It's scary right up until you realize that also means he's already been there. That he's been through everything you're going to go through. That he's already seen your life lived out. And so when we start looking at his instruction book and we start praying and we start asking for guidance, that his guidance is worth trusting in. And he's worth listening to. The third thing I'd like to draw from God's eternal nature being true is that we need to quit acting like we're in this thing alone. Again, I can only speak from my experience, but I go through life constantly having to remind myself that I don't have to act like I'm going through this alone. All the analogies I've said hold up. You're not walking through this parade alone. You've got a God with a bird's eye view trying to give you direction, trying to give you instruction, trying to call the shots. We can ignore him or we can listen. We've got a proverbial Judd saying, hey, I've been here. I know where we're going. Let me give you some guidelines, right? And I don't mean to make Judd the God character. I didn't mean to do that. God knows where you're going, knows where you should go, and would love to direct us. We are not going through this life alone. God is with us. There's a scripture that illustrates that, and I'd like to read that with you. It's in Hebrews, and it's Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15. And it says this, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. God being eternal is a really, really, really big deal. And God being eternal is staggeringly mind-blowing. But that this eternal God would step into time as Jesus Christ, that he would experience temptations, that he would live in this same world that we've lived in, that he would insert himself into time in any way, shape, or form is incredible. It's just incredible. That's one of the key aspects of this scripture that we looked at earlier in Exodus 3, when God appears to Moses in a burning bush and he finishes arguing with Moses by saying, tell them I am sent you. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but it's an extremely intimate situation. God of the universe, God of all time, stepped into this moment with this guy who had murdered an Egyptian and was kind of out in the middle of nowhere and said, write to Moses, I want to use you and I want to free my people and I'm going to use you and I'm going to take the time to argue with you right here. I'm going to win. I'm going to make a great case for why you should listen to me. And that's what God does with us constantly. He looks at all of us and he says, you are worth me stepping into time for. I don't have to, but I'm going to interact with you where you are, how you are. Jesus Christ lived on this world so that he could say this. We don't have a high priest who's unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are. And he didn't sin. Jesus did that so he could die on that cross so long ago and raise again, defeating death, so we can turn to him and say, God, we trust you. God of eternity, we believe in you, and God, thank you so much for entering into our lives. We don't know why you do it, but you do it.